Welcome, everybody, to Space Force, Into Darkness. Today is perhaps one of the most, I think it's fair to call this movie controversial. That's the kind way to approach it. We're here with our usual crew. I'm Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim, and controversial presupposes that there was another side to this argument.
Well, if we're going to find out if we have at last discovered a movie about which Jason has nothing good to say, the answer is no, we have not.
Yeah, there you go. I think I win.
Show noble, guys.
Okay. I'm Aid Smith Steele.
I'm Professor Christopher McLaughlin, but for some reason in this one, I'm being played by a tall, skinny British guy.
Nice. All right. So, Jim, can you start us off with just kind of walking us through kind of how this movie got made? We touched on this a little bit last week. And all I know is the debate over whether or not this was going to be a con movie or not. And I remember like when the 2009 film came out, and I remember hearing them talk about this, like, publicly, like, well, we don't really think we want to do con. That it's kind of the obvious thing to do, and maybe it locks us in, so maybe we'll do something else. And then there was this ridiculous sort of shell game played with the character of Harrison, like, maybe he's, who is he, and we're not going to tell you who he really is, and then, of course, it's obvious that it's con. You mentioned, so you talked about this a little bit last week, but I'm wondering if you can kind of walk us through again with a little bit more expansively.
Okay, so 2009 hits, and it comes out, and Star Trek is awoken. It's like, oh, hey, this is the Onion did a video essay saying Star Trek is now watchable and fans hate it. for a moment there, people were like, hey, this is as harmless as Iron Man was, right? Kind of thinking was the 2009 Star Trek in the popular consciousness. And the DVD comes out. The DVD has a commentary track.
Okay.
And in the commentary track, Bob Olsey goes off into the woods about how they wanted to have a Finding the Botany Bay sequence. And he's on the commentary track with Alex Kurtzman and Damian Lindelof as a producer. J.J. Abrams.
Now, this guy, his name again, is new to me.
Bob Olsey is the guy who wrote the first two movies.
Oh, okay.
Everything you hate about this movie is Bob Olsey's fault. I say that as someone who's very critical of Damian Lindelof.
Okay.
But inherently, like, he's the guy to blame for this movie. And
get him.
And what happens is, Bob Olsey goes off in the weeds. J.J. Abrams sort of reins him back in on the commentary track because, you know, he's all mystery box. And a couple years go by. These people get attached to different projects. It was almost at a certain moment in Hollywood, you couldn't go 3 days without having Alex Kurtzman and Bob Olsey being announced as the new writing team on a new project, relaunching the Power Rangers, the Dark Universe. Like, they were just collecting. And on top of that, they also had Transformers.
Oh.
So they were doing the Transformer franchise while this was happening because they were really in good shape with Paramount because they're making tons of money for them. Then a writer strike happens.
Okay.
And what should have been, what they originally had intended was a 2-year turnaround becomes a 4-year turnaround.
Okay.
And with all of that navel grazing, we now get to a point where Benedict Cumberbatch is announced as the villain in the new Star Trek movie, whose name is not announced.
Okay.
And Benedict Cumberbatch was attached to the movie when it was in its initial stages in the 2-year period before they got bogged down in other projects and the writer's strike.
Yep.
And originally the plan would be that he would be Jim Colt's best friend, Gary Mitchell.
Okay, and Gary Mitchell is from?
Gary Mitchell is from the second pilot, where No Man Has Gone Before, and he becomes the god creature that Colt has to beat up with his own gravestone.
Yeah.
Which, great episode. I love that episode. I would love to see a big budget version of that episode. But that didn't happen because the comic book came out in the time in between this, and the comic book for the first two issues did that story.
I see.
And J.J. Abrams is all about keeping the multimedia machine happy. So his stance was that, and this is the first time Star Trek has ever done this, his stance was that the comics were in continuity.
Okay.
Anything that was like related tangential media is now canon.
So he didn't want to do that story again, so we have to do another one.
And what's the one the one thing the comic book writers were told not to do? Don't touch Khan. So at a certain point before Benedict Cumberbatch is attached to it, Benicio Del Toro was attached to it, and then everyone was like, oh, that's just going to be Khan. Like, Ricardo Montalban is famously a Spanish actor, so Benicio Del Toro can easily fill that role. Sure. Benicio Del Toro drops out, and then they hire Cumberbatch again. And that's where the mystery box concept enters the equation. Okay. Because everyone lied to us. For 2 years while they were filming this movie and editing this movie and cutting this movie and promoting this movie, everyone lied to us, from Simon Pegg all the way down the cast. No, it's not Khan.
Okay.
It's anyone but Khan. And then they announced the name as John Harrison. Which, if you know Space Seed, the original name for Khan was John Erickson.
I see.
So it's already, like, right there, you're like,
Yeah.
All right. And the reason why it was named Khan Noonien Singh is because Gene Roddenberry had a friend in World War II named Khan Noonien Singh.
Interesting. Okay.
So Noonien shows up again, and he's sort of, like, trying to connect to his friend who... Like, Noonien becomes Data's dad, too. Like, so that name means a lot to Gene. That's why Khan has it. And so originally it was supposed to be this Icelandic barbarian sort of king prince in Spacey. And then it became the Sheik concept once they changed the name over.
Yeah.
And then this movie comes out, and I go through an existential crisis.
Okay. You want to save that before we go around?
Oh, yeah. I'll save it.
Abe, why don't you start us off? What did you think of the film?
Okay. So I wanted to start off with doing the things I like about the film, things I didn't like about the film. Unfortunately, I've just gone through my list and I find one good thing I actually like about the film. So if it stands at the moment, my list is very, very short. So again, visually, it's not a bad looking film. Okay. Right. The alien planet at the beginning is great. All those reds, the yellows of the aliens, the actual alien design, it looks really, really nice. It's a genuine alien planet. We've got something that doesn't look like it's filmed in a quarry somewhere. It looks really, really cool. But then you go and ruin it by having the Enterprise come out the ocean and then we'll dive in it. It gets a bit crazy and then breaking the Prime Directive. And then obviously you get, as soon as they arrive at Starfleet, you get the horrible, horrible grey uniforms that just make them look like Imperial Army officers from Star Wars. They're just absolutely, absolutely horrible. And it wasn't until I watched it again this time that I remembered they actually go back to the coloured uniforms of the actual crew parts rather than that grey all the way through. That seems to be the all-encompassing thing I remember about this movie. It's very, very grey. Lots of dark, lots of grey, spaceships are grey, uniforms are grey, everything else grey, 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 even grey moral characters, if you want to go really that far deep. But it's the thing that puzzles me more than anything else is why it's not even like we're going to use Khan again. It's let's do a blatant ripoff of some of the Star Trek II parts and literally just insert them straight into the movie, but just flip them around a little bit and hopefully we'll get away with it because no one will realize. It just seems to be, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to create your own version of Star Trek 2 where everyone can do the Khan shout? Hey, we get this time, we can do it now. The new fans can do the Khan shout. And we get to see the bit in the warp core where Kirk's dying, and we get to see the death scene. Or are they trying to do a nod to the characters and basically trying to say, hey, these destinies, these characters is tied. These characters are always going to have these moments, but it's going to be slightly jiggled around a little bit. And I honestly don't know what they're attempting to try and do. It just seems really puzzling to me. I watched it. I had to watch it over two parts again. I just don't get it. It's just design choices, just the way. This Peter Weller's very good in it. I just quite like Peter Weller in it. He's very cool. Again, the actual core crew members, the actual actors that portray those, they seem to be they do the job okay. But I keep the thing I was finding today more than anything else than the first one was is every time, especially Zachary Quinto came on, I kept to remind myself, oh yeah, this guy's playing Spock. I don't know why that was for this one particularly, but it seemed to be that I had to mentally check myself, say, yeah, okay, Spock, yes. Whereas the first one, he seemed to be more Spocky. I don't know. It was strange. But yeah. So, and again, we also get the unnecessary redesigns of the Klingons, which again, it seems to be very strange as well, because they lose all of their cool costumes we've seen build up over the previous series, and they kind of just, again, they whack him in just some plain grey suits. And it's just, this is terrible. What are you doing? So, yeah, that's kind of it, really. It's just like, yeah, I actually, funny enough, when I watched the bit with the Klingons, I don't actually remember the Klingons being in it that much. I just remember vaguely some Klingons showing up. And then when I watched it, did I mentally blank all of this stuff out when I watched it the first time around? Because I do not remember any Klingons. I remember them literally showing up a bit and thinking, oh, they've got really strange head ridges. Oh, they don't change uniforms. Okay. But there was a fight with Klingons. It's like, okay, yeah, I don't remember that at all. So that all went out my brain. So, yeah, I don't think it made much of an impact on me. So, yeah. So that's pretty much all my I can say at the moment. But, yeah, Chris, if you have anything to share, please do so.
Well, you know, actually, I in some respects, I don't hate this film as much as I did when I first saw it. You know, there's a story about legendary pro wrestling booker Ole Anderson that he once said to a guy, I used to think you were a dumb fuck, but there have been so many dumb fucks who have come along since then. Your ranking has moved up without doing nothing. And I kind of feel that way about this movie, because when I saw it, at the time, I think it was the worst movie I've ever seen in my life. But since then, you know, we've gotten Ready Player One, Batman versus Superman, and heck, after that last Star Wars movie, that was, what, part 87, I think? It's not even the worst J.J. Abrams movie ever made anymore. So I don't hate it as much as I did based on the cinematic experiment of it. But Lord knows, it's still not a good movie. And I think I've narrowed down, I've got it narrowed down to my big two of why I despise this film so much. Writing characters is very difficult work. You know, I mean, there's this thing when you write, you have a character in your head that you love. They come talk to you. I mean, the last book I completed, the characters were writing it for me. I was just transcribing the things they were saying onto paper. But just making sure that you get all the things that you love about a character on the paper to get the audience to feel about a character the way you do, that's real work. And clearly, the people who made this film don't want to do that work. They have some characters in mind who are these idiot assholes. And because they kind of have to be, because these people don't, but they figure they can kind of coast by just naming them after beloved characters that they don't resemble in any meaningful way. It's like my Turkish cinema thesis, you know. I mean, you know, they saw that one episode where Kirk gets busy with a lady and saves the day, and they think that's his whole character. I mean, none of these people in any meaningful way resemble any of their Star Trek forebears, except in like a hacky sitcom-y way. So, you know, I mean, it's just, you don't care for these people. I mean, the part that really lost me this time was this whole business about how it's supposed to be about this friendship between Kirk and Spock. That was clearly there when it was Leonard Nimoy and we that Kirk and Spock should be friends, that they should have any regard for each other at all. It just sort of adds to the pile of, you know, why the hell should Kirk be in charge of anything? I wouldn't trust this Kirk to be a men's room attendant. So you have people who fundamentally don't get these characters and don't want to try. You wed that to a story that's made by the inventors of member berries. And for those of you that don't watch South Park, first of all, my sympathies. You know, South Park, one of South Park's best recent episodes was after the first Abrams Star Wars movie came about. And member berries are this thing that, you know, men of us people, mostly men, but people of a certain age, you know, you just sit back and you eat your member berries. Remember when you were 8 years old and you had a Chewbacca backpack? Wasn't that great? And remember when you wanted R2-D2 to be your best friend? I mean, this is member berry Star Trek. I mean, it's just, we're going to throw in familiar bits, and that's pretty much what people all want to see out of a movie. And one of the most depressing things about being a cinephile in the 21st century is you can make a fortune just making these fucking member berry movies. I mean, that's part one and three of the most recent Star Wars trilogy to a T. It's just putting these same exact familiar beats out there. And really, what film did the fans reject? The middle one, where Rian Johnson actually tried to give them something other than member berries. It's only 90% member berries, and they wanted to fillet the man alive. So yeah, I can't get into any of that. It's too loud. It's obnoxious. The story makes no goddamn sense. There's kids right now smashing together action figures, coming up with a better story. But there you go. So my second and final criticism, second final thing I have to say about this is, and I can't take credit for this one at all. This was first brought up by Devin Faraci, who used to write for Birth Movies Death. And just checking, are you still there?
Oh yeah.
Okay. All right. This talking in silence is weird for me. Okay. All right. Yes. Okay. All right. So yeah, Devin Faraci used to write for Birth Movies Death. And okay, I know somebody's going to Google him and going to find this out. Yeah, Faraci's a piece of shit. He was justly fired twice.
We're going to include a link to this article in the show notes for this episode.
Okay. So please don't, you know, no mail. Don't send us letters. You know, don't think, oh, you're sticking up for Devin Faraci. No, I'm not. Faraci's a piece of shit. There you go. There's your quote. But one of the more perceptive things that he came across was he linked a bunch of tweets from Robert Orsi. Orsi's a 9/11 truther, which, you know, makes him a piece of shit too. I mean, I'm sorry. If you're a 9/11 truther, fuck you. I don't care. I hate you. You're stupid. Get a life. And he argues in quite persuasive detail that this whole thing about, you know, this being a government inside job. Yeah, this is basically just grafting Orsi's 9/11 truther bullshit onto Star Trek. And, you know, there's no franchise that I hate badly enough to see 9/11 truther bullshit grafted onto it. I don't want to see a 9/11 truther Twilight movie, okay? It's just two bad things that go worse together. So, yeah, so, I mean, the only thing about this film that makes it, the only way they could make it, that you could make this whole god-awful Trek reboot worse is to put this guy's insane bigoted conspiracy theories onto it. I mean, that makes it one of the most disgusting works of art ever made. So even though technically I didn't hate it as much of a film, knowing that this is all trying to take something that I have loved my whole life and turn it into a servant of one of the most evil ideas floating around out there. Yeah, just fuck everybody associated with this movie. They should all shame. They should all get out of the movie business for having anything to do with this piece of shit.
The problem they have more than anything else is since they introduced Section 31 as this kind of undercurrent of Starfleet doing these conspiracy stuff, it was bound to happen that, there's evil in Starfleet. Those stories going to show up every time they're there. And obviously it was going to hit the franchise at some point. As soon as they mentioned Section 31, you knew, okay, we know exactly where this is going. So the idea they were kind of like that it's a conspiracy thing, kind of start the wars rather than like a Black Ops thing, is that's kind of where they changed it. But the introduction to Section 31 is responsible for a lot of things. Obviously, they show up in a lot of the subsequent series after DS9, which I believe is the first time they show up. And it's always something, not like, hey, we're doing something slightly off the records. It's always, no, we're doing something quite dodgy. So,
well, I think there's a palpable difference where it was introduced in Deep Space Nine to make characters make clear moral choices in the best Star Trek tradition, than it being used as an excuse to throw another member berry into the story and have this asshole Orsi sit in the theater next to me, elbow me, and keep going, "See sheeple, see sheeple."
Okay, even Discovery's use of Section 31 to be kind of like they want to capture that the information. and keep it to themselves wasn't technically a, hey, let's start a war with the Klingons thing, which is obviously what they're trying to do here. So again, you're right in kind of drawing parallels with, you know, conspiracy theories rather than black ops. So, yeah.
Well, that was Devin Farage.
The interesting thing about Discovery is that everyone knows Section 31's a thing. Like, the Section 31 becomes the CIA, whereas in Deep Space Nine, a couple of centuries later, they're so underground that they've forgotten them. Like, that was a story there that's interesting. So it's not exactly a Membleberry. Like, I would say Membleberry Section 31 is definitely Enterprise. Like, because then it's just there literally to make one of the crewmen on the show, oh, he's been a Section 31 agent all along. It's in the fourth season. It's like, it goes nowhere, it does nothing.
Chris, do you want to hand off now? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, sorry. I just use fuck you instead of your turn. Sorry, my bad.
Where do I go from now? So like I prefaced, and Chris has done the heavy lifting on taking the piss out of Bob Olsey, so I'm not going to beat that. I'm not going to beat that dead horse. My problem with the movie is it takes us 4 years to get here. It takes us 4 years in real time, and the thing about the 2009 Star Trek movie, though, it's not a great film. I think it's a good film. It's an okay film. But it's the promise of what's going to be next. Like, what's the next story that you tell that is a revitalized Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and Uhura, who are drastically different from their original counterparts, but just enough the same that you now don't have to worry about time travel. You don't have to worry about how does this work. You don't have to have two or three exposition scenes stacked up on top of one another to explain it. You can go anywhere they want. And where they wanted was Wrath of Khan. And my fundamental problem with this film is that everyone is exactly where they were when this movie started. Emotionally, in terms of their jobs, the only one who gets shafted is Pike. Pike is shot in an inglorious death. And we've added Carol Marcus to the cast. Like, nothing else changes. Kirk is still about to embark on his 5-year mission, which is this weird sort of concept they add at the beginning of the movie that, okay, why was that included? Khan goes right back to sleep. And Khan going right back to sleep, which is where he starts out 6 months before, is my biggest problem with this movie. Because, yes, there's the 9/11 truth or isn't concept. But then there's this Guantanamo Bay, they're in an extra legal situation, they're outside of the normative judicial process. And the only one person did anything wrong in the whole movie, and that's Khan. We don't see let's go back to Spacey. Because this is a weird bastardization of both Spacey and Wrath of Khan. Yes, Wrath of Khan is more obvious, but in terms of like being introduced to someone and then having to navigate those waters of who is this person. Like, that, these are spacey beats. And with this movie, they don't show anyone doing anything wrong. Like, in the original Spacey episode, you see the guy almost about to hit Uhura in the conference room. You see them holding up the crew. You see them trying to kill Kirk. Like, throwing them into the the depression booth, whatever that was. Like, you see them.
Depression chamber.
Thank you. You see them all doing actions that are bad. They're bad guys. We see it. Instead, what we have is one man who goes above and beyond doing evil things in the name of his family. So there's his sort of like his out. Like, oh, I can understand having to kill someone to protect my family. But he has to do stupid things to do it. Like, I'm going to put my family inside torpedoes. I am never putting my son inside a torpedo. Oh, no. Like, that's like, if that's the start of my zombie apocalypse plan, I need to rethink it or I'm missing my brain. And we're told, like, Khan's a super intelligent man. But no, he's like, he'll little Timmy, Go inside the torpedo. He only wants to use it one time. There's just so many dumb things in this movie. And Khan has to be an idiot to get it
to this. The thing I don't get about it is, obviously, we've got time travel, okay? But we're in a parallel universe, but anything previous to the Kelvin being destroyed is prime universe timeline, right? So
not necessarily.
That's true.
Because Chekhov is born 4 years earlier than he should have been born.
Yes, okay. So yes.
I looked it up because I like watching the 2009 track, I was like, this is real. Like Chekhov 17 whiz kid should not be here. Because he should be 14.
Okay. So technically it should be fixed up until the point of the Kelvin come along, but obviously something's going on. Right. So these characters we have that are obviously augments from Earth. Okay, so these apparently, if you go back into look all the Khan stuff going on, these were the people that ruled the Earth after World War III and the Eugenics War and all this kind of stuff going on there. They're all so technically speaking, they're all the same abilities that Khan possesses. So the idea that they have to rescue Kirk by using Khan's blood is also bullshit. There's 72 others sitting in tubes. You can just pop one out, and that's it. Yeah, and like I said, the other thing being is you can understand that they could be in stasis tubes because obviously if they find the Botany Bay and wake up. But the idea, why did he put me in missiles as well? I don't understand. You can understand if he says there's 72 missiles. Go, okay, well I know who they are. There's 72 crew members. That would at least be. But the idea is, oh, I put them in myself. What were you planning to do with them? What was the idea? I don't get it. So. But the other thing, because we've had this consistent, like you said about Chekhov's age, I believe the comic book also did a thing where they mentioned the mud incident in this when they actually take the shuttle down. And in the comic book, Mud is a female rather than male. And again, that doesn't make sense. Mud is older than Kirk, so therefore he should have been born before the Kelvin thing happened. It should be prime universe Mud. There shouldn't be any reason for changing it. So they seem to mess around with stuff and just basically the idea that it is an offshoot universe, they've kind of now just gone, well, we've got all these ideas, just chuck them in the air, see where they land, and we'll just keep them like that. We won't actually explain it. If they originate from before that time, don't worry about it. We'll just ignore that fact. So there is no kind of acknowledgement that we are now dealing with an offshoot universe. It's now virtually its own thing instead now.
Mm-hmm. So, Aid, to that point, because people after 2009 Star Trek, the fans were like, wait a minute, these things don't make sense. Like, within the narrative of your structure, like this time travel incident happens, and then we'll parallel universe. Like that's the line the fans take, right? That's the line the movie takes.
Back to the Future. I know it works.
Well, what happens is the Olsi and Kurtzman, they all did interviews around the same time, saying that it was like dropping a stone inside a lake, and that the ripples of the time were changing things backwards and forwards. So they just convoluted it to be able to explain away whatever they wanted to explain away. So Mud being female is a result of the ripple. Or Chekhov being born only is a result of the ripple. My big old point is that we never see or even talk about Khan's 72 supermen. So they are sitting there in cryotubes just because they happen to know the asshole who tried to, you know, who crash-landed a starship into San Francisco Bay. Like, we don't know that they're evil. We don't know that they even tried to take over the Earth because there's this weird nebulous gray matter of a narrative plot device that says time has been irrevocably changed going forwards and backwards, and it doesn't make any sense.
There's actually, I don't think, there's no mention at all of the Eugenics War. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. There's no background. There's not even, oh my God, Khan doing his thing. Okay, well, I know who he is now. There's no even reference to even when everyone acknowledging who he even is when he reveals his real name. So it kind of falls flat in that respect as well. Yeah.
Remember when you were 8 and you went to see that movie with Khan in it? Wasn't that great? That's all these filmmakers, that's as much as they care about this.
Which again seems to suggest that the people they're trying to sell this movie to is people that already know who Khan is. Because they say, well, we don't need to explain say we haven't seen Space Seed, we don't need to explain who he was. Let's just ignore it. So it's like, well, why are you retreading stuff we've already seen before then? This is even more ridiculous.
Because the people who made this film are completely and utterly convinced that's all filmmakers want.
Well, yeah, I suppose after seeing certain beats in the, like you say, in Star Wars, the new one, the first one, Force Awakens, yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. So if we're still doing turns, can I do one?
I haven't gone.
Go on, Jason.
I was waiting for the handoff.
Yeah, Jason looks so unhappy just sitting there stewing.
I'll try to address that. I watched this film just a couple of days ago, and I've been thinking about it a lot ever since. Like Chris, I found I didn't dislike the movie as much as I thought I would when I watched it. And first off, I want to talk to the people that might be watching or listening and thinking, this is your favorite Star Trek movie. Good. Keep loving it. Like, do your thing. Maybe you just think that it's entertaining or that it's just fun. Maybe you like the action sequences. Maybe you like the way that the younger cast, like maybe it's the special effects, whatever it is that make you love this movie. Good. Keep loving it. I think there's some very interesting things that are good about this film. And I want to, the simple stuff first, the stuff that seems kind of obvious or maybe not so important. And that's the production of the film, the stuff that other than the story, which has some challenges that I'll get to when we get back around. But the interior sets of the Enterprise, the music, the costumes of the characters on the ship, I agree with you, Aid. I don't like the gray Admiralty command uniforms at all that we see back at Starfleet headquarters. But once they get back on the ship and everyone's wearing the costumes from the 2009 setup, I like that. I like the interiors of the ship. I think it feels like a cool, bright. And I have to be honest with you, the lens flares don't even bother me, to be frank.
I think there's less lens flares in this one than the previous one. I swear there is. I think they gauged it down a little bit.
It's a cool. I like the way the film is made that surrounds the characters and their dialogue and their plot. I love the music. Okay. And now let's get into this other thing I think about this film. I disagree with you, Jim. You said that you felt like everybody is back exactly where they were at the beginning of the movie. And physically, that might be true. But I believe that mentally, emotionally, there is a change in the Kelvin version of Jim Kirk. And Chris, you are absolutely right. Like, this is not the Jim Kirk that we know. This is a completely different character who has the name Jim Kirk. He's played by a different actor, and he's completely different. And that's jarring for people like me who grew up watching original series when I was 8, watching over summer reruns when I had no school to go to and I could just watch Star Trek all day. He's a different character. And I thought about it a lot, and I figured out that this is the movie about how Jim Kirk, this Jim Kirk, the Kelvin Jim Kirk, Kirk with a little superscript of a K after his name, goes from chaotic good to neutral good. Like, those of you who know me, I want to gamify everything. In the first movie, the 2009 film, Kirk is not just a guy who breaks the rules. He intentionally tries to break rules. Like, he doesn't, whether it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do is irrelevant. He breaks the rule because he sees it as a personal challenge and he enjoys breaking the rule. That's how he starts this movie. And what I like about this movie is that all that shit that we hate about Jim Kirk with a K, this movie addresses at the beginning when Pike dresses him down and says, you lied on a report. Like, you don't respect the job. You weren't ready. And every one of us, this is exactly what we said last week. Son of a bitch, Pike, you're right. And whose fault is this? It's partly Pike's. Like, Pike has some blame for this. And I think that the actor conveys that he feels responsible for it. And, you know, people like to dump on Chris Pine, but I happen to think that he does a pretty damn good job in this movie. And when he realizes that his future, his career, is getting flushed down the crapper, you can see it in his face. And then there's that fantastic scene at the bar when Pike finds him at the bar and he reveals to Kirk that he has saved his career. I'm going to make you my first officer. You're still going to be on the Enterprise, and I'm going to teach you how to be a good captain. And if you look at Pike, and I swear to God, go watch that scene, he's about to cry. You can see the character, like, he was at his lowest low, and he's been given a second chance. And Pine sells it. In that moment, he sells it to me. And from that point forward, he's struggling with, like, okay, what am I going to do? When they get to the border of Klingon space, and Spock has been telling him, and by the way, that scene when they're walking through the hallway, and Kirk is like, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and Spock is like, okay, that's an Arab proverb by a guy who has got his head chopped off by his own people. I fucking laughed. I thought the delivery on that was great. And there was, this film was filled with moments of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. At least a couple, maybe not filled. There were a couple of them. But they really felt like true Star Trek to me. And I never really understood this about the three characters until, Jim, you unpacked this so well for me. And now I get it. Like, there's McCoy arguing from emotion. There's Spock arguing from logic. And Kirk is like, look, guys, we have to do something. Like, he's the action guy. And now I get that trilogy so well, I want to duplicate it in a game. And I'm not going to be able to rest until I do.
But Jason?
Yeah.
I don't know where you would find it today other than my house, so I guess you have to come visit me. Okay. The Classic Trek collectible card game nails that dynamic better than anything, with the possible exception of the Modiphius game, better than any other Trek-related game I've ever played. It is one of the most outstanding game designs ever.
Interesting. Okay, so anyway, they get to the edge of Klingon space. And Kirk has been like, we're gonna shoot these 72 torpedoes. And by the way, I think the whole biz with the torpedo and the reason why, like, the whole weird plot thing of the torpedoes that you're putting people inside, like, that's kind of ridiculous. And Jim is like, what the hell? I get it. It's totally whack. And I think where it comes from, and I don't know what happened in the writing room, but I think that it's a weird kind of Genesis device permutation, right? Because I know. But, like, the Genesis torpedo, like, that line gets used, you know, in Star Trek 3, and we think of it as, like, where's the torpedoes come from? And but anyway, I don't know. That's another – I digress. But they get to the edge of Klingon space, and Kirk has been like, we're going to fire these torpedoes, and we're going to blow this guy up to death, and we're not going to try him. And then suddenly at the last minute, he's like, no. He looks over at Spock. Spock just looks at him back like, you know what I'm going to say. And he's like, okay, fine. We're gonna go in there. We're going to grab him, and we're going to bring him back, and we're going to subject him to trial. And then the rest of this movie is him sticking up for the law, which is the craziest thing for Kirk to be doing. Until finally, by the end of this movie, he's no longer trying to break every rule. That his number one priority is not breaking every rule I see, because that's what gets me off. Instead, he's trying to think the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that's when he goes up, and we'll talk about the plot when we come back around, because that whole thing is extremely problematic, as we like to say in academia. But when Kirk is at, when he does all that, okay, fine. And he's back at the plexiglass shield, and Spock is there, and we're doing this weird, bizarre, mirror version of the Wrath of Khan Spock scene. But there's a couple of lines that aren't from that scene, that are original. And one of them is when Pine is lying against the glass, and he says, I'm afraid, Spock. I'm scared. That was a gutsy line to write. It's a gutsy line to make Chris Pine say, and he totally stole it. And there are not a lot of these moments in the movie, but there are moments when the script writers and the actors dare to do something gutsy. And I just I love those moments. There's a lot that I don't love about the movie, but I love those moments. To have a character like Kirk admit that he's afraid, to die. And not very many heroes are allowed to ever say something like that in their death scene. You know, it's always the brave, sacrificing martyr play. But to have Kirk admit that he was scared, and Pine fucking sells it. He had it for that moment. And so this is the story for me. And when of a character that starts off chaotic good, and as Jonathan Tweet has written extensively elsewhere, chaotic good is the most popular alignment in gaming, right? Like, everybody wants to make chaotic good characters because they see that as heroic, especially in America. But this is a guy who starts off chaotic good, but he becomes neutral good. He's a guy who is not his job. He is not desired to break the law. That's not his first rule. His first rule is what's the right thing to do. Now, if I have to break the rules to do it, okay, I will. but I don't have to break the rules if I don't have to, right? Well, and you it, and then at the very end of this movie, Kirk swaggers back on the bridge, right? But it's not the same swagger. Like, compare it to that last few minutes of Star Trek 2009 that we saw last week. And he's not like the big sort of macho swagger that he had in the first film. And when he talks to Carol, you know, it's like, hey, I'm glad to have you part of the family. And Carol's a huge missed opportunity in this movie. And the fact that she gets introduced and then we never see her in Star Trek Beyond is an incomplete pass that is worth a whole nother conversation. But I thought there were moments in this movie that I found strong. And I thought a lot of that was due to the cast, especially the bridge crew cast, who I thought worked really hard. And they had moments, they worked the best they could with kind of the shit sandwich they were given. And yeah, so that's kind of my thought on that. And we'll come back around, and I have some things I don't like, but I'm saving those for the second half. Abe, your turn.
Okay, so I don't know what else to say, because I write my notes literally as I watch this film. Every time something picks up, I scribble it down on a little bit of paper. And after about the first like 2/3 of the film, it was just like I've not written anything down, because you just kind of go along with the flow, but nothing really jumps out as being noteworthy in a good way or in a bad way. It just kind of just continues onwards and just plunders along. And I don't quite understand what the point of killing Kirk off literally to bring him back 5 minutes later. I don't get that at all. I don't see the actual justification for that. As Jim mentioned, killing Pike off was a big mistake. Pike was always a good character in the first one, and then you kill him, and it's like, okay, well, that's fair enough. Carol Marcus obviously being another one where they brought her in, and I think she plays a good version of Carol Marcus. But it's almost like those typical kind of TV episodes where, you've met your love of your life in 45 minutes, though, she'll be gone. There'll be another one next week. And it just seems, what is the point? I mean, whether or not Alice Eve, whether or not she didn't want to come actually to be into Beyond, or whether they didn't approach her, who knows? We obviously get a name check for Nurse Chapel as well via her character, so there's other stuff going on. But there's just, again, fundamental stuff that I've seen in the stuff about the idea, like, they don't seem to understand how phases work in the Next Generation Technical Manual, anyway, it gives you all the settings. You can set the phases to be destructive. They can explode so much footage. You think when he shoots at that ship, it just kind of bounces off. And you go, well, just up the bloody numbers on the phaser. You'd take it out of the sky, no problem. Ah, no, I've got a fire hose here. That'll do the job much better. It just seems to be they're writing it from kind of like a cool, mid-2000 action movie vibe rather than the Star Trek vibe. They're not actually trying to put Star Trek stuff in it. They're just kind of trying to insert Star Trek stuff into an action film. I mean, even the fight on the back of the ships, the fist fight with Spock and Khan, is literally straight out of episode 3, where they fight the lightsaber battle above the lava planet. It seems that we've seen stuff like this before. It just seems to be just kind of like, as the member berry thing, snapping stuff up from other films, action movies more than anything else, and just kind of putting a Star Trek paint job on them and saying, well, there you go, off you go, out the door, you can continue onwards now, and we'll get another film soon anyway, so we'll worry about something more sci-fi next time. So, but yeah, so that's pretty much it, really. That's all I can say. So, Chris, carry on.
Well, you know, it was gently suggested that I talk too much and I'm too negative, so I'm trying to be quiet and positive this week. And what a heck of a week to try to be positive. So I'm trying to find something positive to say. And so yes, I actually have something positive to say about this movie. Of all the many, 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 many things out there, just absolutely taking the piss out of this movie, and deservedly so. One of the funniest things I ever saw was there was an animated film showing like why this movie makes all other Star Trek irrelevant, because you can beam across the galaxy anywhere you need to go, so you don't need Star Trek, you don't need starships anymore, and everybody's immortal, because between the transporter tech that they use that Khan's blood basically makes you immortal, you know, there's no point in doing anything anymore. And while I have to admit, maybe not the best use of the storytelling art to come up with magic technology like that, I have to concede that the idea of coming up with a miraculous discovery and never mentioning it again, not exactly new to the franchise. Granted, I'm going to be going back to season 3 of the original series, which you should probably never do, but season 3 is there. It's canon. There's no running away from it. You know, you can't help but notice that, you know, that when, you know, in all the subsequent Star Trek franchises, sometimes somebody had a real problem with something. Nobody loaded up on, was it Kyranide from Plato's Stepchildren and just used those telekinetic powers to fix everything. You know, nobody drank the Skolosian water that they found in Wink of an Eye, because even though, yeah, you're taking a real, you know, one scratch kills you, they have the antidote to it by the end of the episode. You know, many people in Star Trek be willing to risk that. So I will, in the spirit of unity and concord and love and all that good shit, I will go ahead and give this movie a pass on coming up with amazing, miraculous technology that's never mentioned again. And other than, you know, just, I hate this fucking film and everybody from it should get out of the motion picture business, I just have one other positive story. It's about Space Seed, and with everyone else's permission, if it's okay with you, Jason, we can just end the show with that because it's a happy story.
Go ahead and do it now.
You want me to do it now? Are we finishing up?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So last time that I watched Space Seed, it was when I got the latest iteration of the Star Trek Blu-rays. And I noticed something in it that in my previous 700,000 viewings in standard def, originally on antenna TV, I noticed a detail that I had never seen before. Everybody probably knows that episode by heart, just like I do. You know, they find this derelict ship, they find this unknown group of people, they awaken one of them, bring him back to the Enterprise. They know nothing about him until he wakes up and, you know, he pulls the scalpel on Bones. And then Bones calls Jim Kirk to come down and says, you know, I have a passenger with many questions. And then there's an edit. There's a certain time lapse before, you know, Kirk gets down to sick bay. Well, I think it's the scene immediately after that. If not, it's not too much long after that. But if you look very, very, very closely, you notice that Khan has taken every single pillow off of every single bed in the hospital unit and is using them all himself.
Great.
And this is before you know anything else about him. Yeah. So right away, it's telling you that, what is that great line that Montalban has in there? You know, I'm a man who's not afraid to take what he wants.
That's great.
You've already gotten this great visual cue of what kind of guy you're dealing with there.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was fucking brilliant. And I'm the first one to notice this. I don't know, but I just thought that was such a great, great, great little no cost, no budget, quiet. I mean, how much quieter could it get? I missed noticing it for 50 years. It was so quiet and subtle. Mm-hmm. And you know, whatever the Onion wants to say, you know, something that's quiet and thoughtful and clever like that, I'll take that. So there you go. So salute to the original series and the pillow gag. And I'm out.
Jim?
All right. So with the new structure of this episode is kind of throwing me for a loop. There was a lot I can sit here on. I can spend the next 2 hours easily dissecting this movie. There's very little I like about this movie. But just as the filmmakers have taken so much from Star Wars, my last thought is going to be taking something from the Star Wars fan community. So after the prequels, the Star Wars fan community has gone out and made a small little cottage industry of rebooking the prequels. And some of them are drastic rewrites, and some of them are small rewrites, and some of them are all just like, wow, that's just fantasy booking.
I myself have done this when I tried to run a Star Wars campaign rewriting the prequels.
Yeah, like we've all sat there because we all saw A New Hope or Star Wars, and we all hold the line of the Clone Wars, and we all conjured up something. Like every 5-year-old who saw that movie was like, there was something there. Like, I know what a clone is. I don't know what a Clone War actually looks like. And you came up with something of weird, and then we got those movies. So they all sort of went out, and when they got those bad movies, they just started making them, you know, their sort of fantasy book. So in that spirit, I'm going to fantasy book Into Darkness for 5 minutes. All right, so I'm going to take all the big elements of the movie. You got the original series cast has been reunited. You have the Enterprise. You even have the opening. I actually like the opening. There was a couple things I would change about it, but the opening action sequence, the Bondian sort of like Kirk and company go on mission and fuck things up. I actually think that's really good. I like the scene with Pike in the room when he gives them the lecture. He dresses them down. I think all of that is good Star Trek. I really like the Pike cult ball scene. I think it's the best scene in this movie, but I'm rewriting it, Jason. So with that in mind, the only thing I'm taking from Wrath of Khan is Wrath of Khan's focus on literary references. So in Wrath of Khan, you have Kirk, who's doing Tale of Two Cities, and you have Khan, who's doing Moby Dick. In that spirit, I am doing Khan Paradise Lost. In Space Seed, the very last line that Khan says is a reference to Milton. And then Scotty goes, and this was my first introduction to Milton as a kid. And then Scotty goes, as a good Scotsman, I have to admit, I don't know what he's referring to. And then Kirk, the American, has to explain to the Scotsman what Milton's saying about ruling in hell, as opposed to bending the knee in heaven.
Paradise Lost is on the Botany Bay bookshelf in Star Trek II.
Mm-hmm. It's a great line. It's great thinking. So Khan, we've already had this new Khan. He's more savage. He doesn't want to. He doesn't care about the Federation. He goes off. He's going to take over the Klingon Empire. They find it's not humans that find the Botany Bay. It's Klingons, and they wake up their worst nightmare. And it's a human who thinks he's Superman. So Kirk ball sequence. The movie's pretty much the same up to that point. And then for Kirk's plot point, it's Dante's Inferno. So it's Kirk and Cole of the Klingon Empire, the rebooted Kelvin version of John Chiklis's character from the original TOS, and they are on a separate mission to infiltrate the Klingon Empire, to go into hell following Khan and try to take back the Klingon throne. Meanwhile, Carol Marcus is Beatrice. And Carol Marcus is contacting Kirk via holograms and like messages. And through the whole movie, this is a woman that he can't objectify. She sees an image, she's talking to him, and he starts falling in love with her. He starts having emotions towards her that aren't just physical gratification. My whole problem with the first movie is Kirk's objectification of women. I want to address that here. So Kirk, Cole, and Carol Marcus all together infiltrating Klingon space. Carol Marcus, meanwhile, is on the Klingon homeworld with Khan because this is Space Seed. This is not Wrath of Khan. And in Space Seed, MacGyvers is the one who betrays Kirk. So that's what we're heading towards. Meanwhile, Pike, Enterprise, you could do the whole Tonkin incident thing. I actually kind of think that's a clever setup. I don't like the torpedoes at all. But I think that concept of Enterprise stranded on Klingon border as prelude to Vietnam War is interesting. You could flesh it out. Put Pike there. Pike with Spock, I think, is always good. I don't want to kill Pike, but I'm going to. End of the movie, we get to the point where we've just spent all this time going to Klingon space, humanizing the Klingons. Well, Kirk sees his enemy that he's made up in the original films. Like, we've gotten to that point. We're hitting all those notes. And you see Cole as a multifaceted Klingon. He's all spokesman for what these new Kelvin Klingons are like. They get to the final confrontation. Carol Marcus betrays Kirk, breaks his heart. It's that bonding Casino Royale moment in the film. But still, Kunk and Cole still have to beat up Khan. So there was the fight sequence because these are action movies. At which point Pike shows up, winds up being killed, and he's like, you can't kill Khan. He does that thing where you let the laws decide this. And Cole kills him. It's that scene from Next Generation where Ryko comes in and goes, no, and Wolf plunges his Bat'leth into Doros's chest, and Arno is satisfied. And Cole is now triumphant. Because the whole movie, you build up this human interpretation, and then the last moment, as the switcheroo, well, you realize, oh no, he's a fucking Klingon. We like him, but he's still a fucking Klingon. And that's why I would book Star Trek Into Darkness with Kunk, Cole, and Carol Marcus in Dante's Inferno, Khan on Paradise Lost, and that's my movie. That's the movie I want. I don't want to see Klingon show up and just become stormtroopers. And my 5 minutes is done.
Well, the best thing about that is that Kor becomes Virgil, which I would write a whole essay on.
That was the whole thinking was okay, I already have this Khan element as he's trying to take over hell. What's the other famous hell story? Yeah. Dante's Inferno. So.
Well, first of all, fucking incredible as always, Jim. I would applaud, but no one could hear it. But I'm applauding. Oh, trust me, I'm applauding. That's awesome. If you don't mind, I add the one scene I always wanted to see in this reboot.
What's that?
I always wanted to see a scene where Kirk gets called up before Starfleet Command for some reason, and he goes in to meet the Starfleet Admiralty. And the Starfleet Admiralty is William Shatner, Kate Mulgrew, Avery Brooks, and they've done Enterprise at that point. So yeah, we could throw in Scott Bakula, and they give Kirk a very meta speech about how it's all on him now. He's the one carrying the ball forward now, and you give each of them their moment. Now, granted, you might have to lose a fight scene to afford a cameo fee for all those people, but to me, totally worth it.
See, I would counter that and say the only one I would keep would be Scott Bakula.
What's that?
I would counter that and say the only one I keep of that cast is Scott Bakula, and just make it Jonathan Archer.
Well, again, the odd thing being is that Admiral Archer gets mentioned in Star Trek First One as having his beagle transported. Yeah. So is that supposed to be him? Is it not?
I mean, dramatically that works for me too. But I mean, I figure if I'm pitching this to a bunch of member Barry obsessed producers, why half do it? Give people the ultimate member Barry moment.
All right, Jason, take us home. We've gone off the rails. I'm in fantasy booking land. We're getting Avery Brooks out of retirement. How do you crystallize your final thoughts in Star Trek?
It sounds like a great movie, by the way. And I never want to say no to another Avery Brooks show. I was a kid when Vegas was being filmed in Vegas. I was living in Vegas when the show was being made. And I remember Avery Brooks as a, you know, supporting character on that show.
I think you're thinking of Spencer for Hire.
You're right. I am thinking of Spencer for Hire. Yeah. Thank you. I should have known that. So you guys there's a lot that's really bad about this movie. As usual, when I look at what's bad in a film, I see it as a goddamn tragedy because the film could have been so great, in my opinion, but it was so let down. By frankly, just like lazy writing. Chris, when you say that it takes a lot of effort to make these characters and effort that the writers just didn't want to do. And that's exactly what we see. Like the whole like pastiche of the Kirk Spock death scene where we just take the same lines and we recycle them and we make people, it's just so goddamn lazy. It doesn't make me angry, it makes me sad. It makes me sad that people, young Americans, get exposed to this movie and they think that this is Star Trek. And I'm like, oh, it could be so much better than this. And, you know, they probably have never seen Star Trek II. And they recognize Khan because Khan has become a cultural joke. Like, that's the thing that people remember. And that's why you can put the stupid Khan scream in this movie and make Spock say it this time. It is because the scream is more, has more of a cultural imprint than the movie itself that it comes from. But I'm wandering off my topic. Aid, you talk about how the action sequences are just action movie stuff, and it's not really uniquely Star Trek. And you can tell that you're exactly right, because every time the transporter would break the action movie sequence, the transporter somehow can't work, right? Like, why can't we just beam them up? Well, no, I can't find, they're moving too fast. You have beamed people up moving at warp speed. How could they be going too fast? You have caught people falling to their deaths. How could they be moving too fast? They're on the back of a goddamn airplane. Beam them up, right? But we can't beam them up because that would ruin the action sequence. And that's all that it is. That's the only reason why they can't beam them up. And they do this multiple times through the movie. When you have a universe with transporters, you have to write new problems. You have to write problems that transporter can't solve. That's hard. People do hard things. Okay. Like, you spend the energy and time required to do it the hard way. Instead of just like throwing out some bullshit, making poor Chekhov. What's the actor's name again?
Anton Yelich.
Yelich. Making him say yet again why we can't use transporters to resolve this problem.
And the irony being is that's exactly what he did in the first film, because he was the only guy that could do it. Yeah. So he managed to track him down the first film, but he can't do it now on. But this also, sorry, Jason, but this is also something Insurrection did well, is when you had the thing about the stuff in the mountains, and they said, okay, we can't shoot them out. Oh, well, we get the drones to beat the transporter things on so they can enhance the signal. It's like, well, they've done it in that. They kind of wrote themselves to give a reason, but they also wrote themselves to get around that reason to say, okay, we can slow it down rather than just beaming all 40 aboard. At least we can do it one at a time. There must be something like that. Like you say, it's just lazy writing.
There's moments. So one of the things I hated the most about the first film was what Jim is bugged by, which is Kirk's constant objectification of women. That every moment when you think that the film is going to give us something great, like, oh, hey, there's Orions in Starfleet. Yeah, but the only reason why there's an Orion girl in Starfleet is so that she can be mostly naked in bed with Kirk. Like, that's it. And it's so goddamn tragic. And then it happens again with Marcus. Like, I like the idea of putting Carol Marcus in here. But the trouble is we know nothing about her. The only thing we're told that she's an expert in weapons appears to be forced so that she can get on board the ship. She is nothing but her father's daughter. And then we have that ridiculous don't turn around scene where we just have to watch her be naked in the shuttle for no reason except to titillate the 12-year-olds in the audience. And I hate it when the movie talks down to me like that. It have you no respect for me? Like, come on, man. Treat me like an adult. So that pissed me off. It's the same reason why I stopped watching Enterprise after the first episode, but we've already talked about that. All right, so there's a lot of things that this film, I just feel it lets me down on. And the biggest letdown, and I'm going to end on this because we've gone over an hour already. I've already talked about how I actually think that Kirk's death is not terrible. Like, I think that Pine sells it. The problem with it is that we all know it's not going to stick. That ridiculous Tribble explainer thrown in right at the moment when he's in the middle of talking to Khan, like, okay, there's McCoy bringing a Tribble back from the dead. Like, okay, well, it's as bad as before, right? Coming in the middle of Nemesis. Like, it's such an obvious plot lever that we're going to put in. It's the gun on the mantelpiece, except that it's a vial of Khan's blood. And as soon as you put it there, we know that someone's going to die, and we're going to use this potion to bring them back from the death. And look, you set up this arc for Kirk where he transforms as a person. He saves the ship. You should let him goddamn die. That should have been the hard choice would have been to let Kirk die and end the movie with Kirk dead. And if you want to bring him back and do another movie like they did with the whales, okay, fine. But let it be self-contained. And at the end of the story, Kirk demonstrates that he has grown and he dies in the process. And that's the end of the movie. And it was there. It was the apple on the tree. And they all you had to do was pluck it. But they didn't have the guts. And it's just, it's a goddamn tragedy.
So there was someone who wrote a little opinion piece saying that Culp should have died the way you said, Jason, yeah. Except wound up like haunting Spock. Like the way you would continue the franchise is like, at one point they have a mind meld, and then there was a remnant of Culp in Spock's brain, and that's how you can keep Chris Pine on the payroll.
You don't need to do that. I mean, there's a million ways we can bring Chris Pine back from the dead if we have to. I mean, this is Star Trek, but
that's true.
But even with Kirk doing that and braving himself and not actually dying, but at least facing his own mortality would be something, because at least you can say, okay, you nearly died. Now I understand. I've been throwing stuff away. At least that would give some reason to give kind of a change in his lifestyle, ways that you're doing things. But the idea to kill him and then just bring him back straight away just seems like you say, just seems like, well, we can bring him back.
I haven't really talked about Khan at all, because the whole Khan plot line is the worst thing in this movie, and I really don't like it. But Cumberbatch is given this character who is apparently savage. And you can see Cumberbatch trying to be savage on screen. And he's choreographed savage. Like, his fight scenes are, his hand-to-hand physical combat scenes are really brutal. And you can see the fight choreography trying to play that character up. I like Cumberbatch, and I want to see him make six Doctor Strange movies, okay? But the idea of making him Khan and doing this, like, you made the wrong call. And the miraculous blood regeneration thing, that makes no goddamn sense. And because it wasn't in the, like, if it's Khan, then it's Khan. Why is he suddenly English?
I have a short list of actors that may have made a better Khan than Benedict Cumberbatch, and it includes Andy Dick and Abe Vigoda.
Well,
the big thing is it's racist. You're taking, okay, first off, Star Trek casted a Spanish actor to play an Indian. Yeah. Now you're casting a British actor to play an Indian. Yeah. That's what you're doing. You're literally taking away Indian identity by casting inappropriately. Because the whole thing, like, the movie is really smart about not saying Khan, Nudi, and Singh, because those last two words are very, very identified with Indian culture. But then Leonard Nimoy comes up, and if anyone should say Khan, Nudi, and Singh, it is Leonard Nimoy.
Okay. So I'm glad that you mentioned the Nimoy scene, because that scene has no reason to be in this movie.
Yep.
And you can tell that it's a last minute add. It's a reshoot. They add, because right as Spock, young Spock, Spock with a K after his name, right when Spock says, "How did you defeat him?" they cut. And we never hear what regular Spock tells him, because there is nothing original Spock could tell him that would have any actual bearing on the plot of this movie.
That's right. Right. Yeah. Well, we flew into a nebula and we did some stuff. He can't think in three dimensions. Try and catch him out on that one.
He used his inexperience with Starfleet technology and his raging ego to defeat him. Well, that has nothing to do with how Spock with a K actually defeated him with the torpedoes. It's purely fan service. And once again, it's the movie talking down to me, and I hate it when movies talk down to me. Okay. we have gone around a couple of times. We've gone for over an hour. This was the penultimate episode of Space Force, at least this season. Next week, we're going to come back. We're going to be a little bit earlier. There aren't very many folks that ever watch us live, but if you are watching us live, we're going to start half an hour earlier next week, because one of us has got a thing. And then we're going to talk about Into Dark, Into Dark, because that's what we just got out of. We're going to talk about Star Trek Beyond, which I thought at least its heart was in the right place. Does anybody have any recollections of this film to help audiences watch it in the coming week.
I love this movie.
Okay.
Of the three new ones, Star Trek Beyond is the one I love because yeah. Kirk has a character arc yeah. that alludes to stuff from the original series that we never saw.
Yeah.
And as a character arc that is resolved by the end of the movie because yeah. of the movie.
Yeah.
And none of the other movies, Kirk's very stagnant in these films.
Yeah.
We've seen him multiple times. He's Kirk from, this is Shatner Kirk to Chris Pine Kirk. But he has a character arc here that I can appreciate. Okay. That they even included that.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. And I've seen Beyond once before because Into Darkness killed it so much for me that I didn't want to watch it for so long.
Yep.
So this will be an interesting rewatch, yes.
Yeah, I haven't watched this film since it came out. Chris?
There's a line. I'm pretty sure I got it. I'm pretty sure it popped up on Dr. Katz on Comedy Central back in my college years, but it's stuck with me ever since. And it kind of completely sums up my feelings about this film. Look how much it takes to make me not care.
Well, join us next week. In the meantime, thanks to everybody for watching. We'll see you then. Live long and prosper.